In the 1970s, some American food lovers may have known that Morocco has a very special cuisine, but it wasn't until Paula Wolford published her groundbreaking cookbook, Couscous and Other Good Foods of Morocco 40 years ago, that they understood that they could cook it for themselves. Ms. Wolford revisited this cuisine she loves recently with a new, expanded, and beautifully illustrated cookbook called The Food of Morocco, and she was on our show to talk about it and Moroccan food a few months ago. We thought that we would re-air that conversation for you again today. I began by asking her if this was really an updated version of Couscous and Other Good Foods.
It started out that way. I mean, Dan Halpern, the editor-in-chief, asked me to write this book. He said, it's time to update it. So much is available in America. So I went about doing that, but I'm not that kind of person. I realized there were things I could update, but I could deal with that in three paragraphs. What you should buy, what you should do, and let me tell you about what I learned in the last 40 years.
Well, it's still in print.
Yes, the first book is still in print,
so you're
for that reason.
In competition with yourself.
No, that's why I did it.
Has the food scene in New York evolved so much in the interim that you felt you could expand on techniques and on some of the ingredients? You're not living here in New York anymore.
No, but everything is available on mail order. But you know, with Kalustian here in New York, you know, you've got the best store in town, and then you've got Sahadi in Brooklyn. Nobody in New York has a problem getting Moroccan ingredients.
In 1973, Moroccan food was largely unexplored territory, even here in New York, and it's still an exotic food for most of us. If it's so great, why has it taken so much time for Americans to embrace it?
I don't know. You know, Paul Bocuse said there were three great cuisines in this world. There was the Chinese, the French, and the Moroccan. And nobody knows about the Moroccan. And I think a lot of it has to do with restaurants. We are perfectly willing to go to an Ethiopian restaurant and eat with our hands, sit on low tables, and eat the way Ethiopians eat and enjoy it. Moroccan food has been transformed into this expensive little plate in front of you with some belly dancer so that they can get more money. And you never see or enjoy the real food of Morocco because a lot of it has to do with the harmony of the family, the way people eat. Can I tell you about the magic of the tagine?
Of course.
Because
Tagine means two things, doesn't it?
It means the pot, and it also means the dish that goes in the pot. And in all three countries in the Maghreb, that's Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia, the thing that goes in the tagine pot is totally different from each other. But it's a stew. Think of it as a stew. But this is the magic of the tagine, and you will understand everything about Moroccan cooking from what I'm going to tell you. Everybody in the family eats from the center pot.
And they don't use forks and
well,
knives
now
either.
They do, but you usually use the first three fingers of your right hand. Therefore, if I had divided among the six people or the four people into little plates, the dinner plates, you'd look like very little on your plate. But it looks like a lot when you're grabbing. All of a sudden, somebody's at the door. Four people show up. What are you going to do? In Morocco, you have no problem. You just move a little bit aside. Everybody squeezes in. Everybody takes their bread. And there's enough for 10 or 12. How do you explain that? They call that baraka, good fortune. There's always enough food in the tagine pot to feed everyone. Isn't that beautiful? That's what they say.
It's also because rather inexpensive, tougher cuts of meat
exactly
tend to go into the tagine?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, when I lived in Morocco, when you went to the butcher, the most expensive meats and the poorest meats were all the same price because the very rich, which were less amount of people, they bought the more expensive to make grills and meshoui and things, but you really needed all those other parts for everybody else. So it was all the same price.
And does cooking them in a clay pot make them tender?
Yes.
You have a cookbook on just clay pot cooking,
well,
so you've thought a lot about clay pots.
Yes, and, well, it's something I learned, but no one would ever let me publish it. And that is that when tagine especially is a portable oven. It's bottom-up cooking. If you cook a food in a tagine on top of the stove very slowly. It takes 2 to 3 hours to cook a tagine, but you don't have to do anything. It's just like a crock pot, except it's in one third the time. You don't stir. You assemble everything. You put your cone on top, and first the moisture comes and evaporates out of the meat and vegetables, creates a lot of steam, circulates to the high part of the tagine, cools down, and recycles and keeps everything moist. Eventually, the clay on the sides get hot enough, the moisture gets reabsorbed by the vegetables and meat, and guess what? It's an oven, and it bakes off at the end, keeping everything firm.
So it's a combination of steam and also baking.
Yes, and therefore you have the spicing. Everything is in balance. I didn't understand all of this when I was writing my first book. It took me a long time. Nobody ever explained it. In my book, I explained it for pages.
But this book, which is a gorgeous book.
Oh, thank you.
Large, with lots of pictures. We also are expected to rise to the next level of complexity. I noticed somewhat apprehensively that while you recommended substituting phyllo pastry for waka in the first book, now you seem to feel that we're ready to make it ourselves.
Yes, you know why? Because now you can do it with a paintbrush over a skillet. It's so easy. I have a group. It's open to everybody. I have 2,500 members in about 4 months or 5 months. And they're already making it now that they've got their books. All you do in the food processor is blend your pastry, your liquid, make it very liquid, get your paintbrush out, put a skillet on top of a pot of boiling water so that you can control 200 degrees all the time, and then you just paint it on, and then you lift it off.
Wait, it's rather fragile because we're talking about something really thin.
It's so strong. It's stronger than phyllo, tastier than phyllo, and you can freeze it. You can make everything with it, and it tastes better. And I know it sounds crazy. I did not invent this. I found it on an Arab YouTube. It's the hottest thing in Morocco. That's what all the girls are doing. They're painting with it, and I tried it, and it works. And then I really perfected it. I have all the tricks and the trade that I've developed with it. And it's so easy, and I keep it frozen.
So is YouTube your source for all of your recipes?
No, not at all.
How do you get people to share their recipes? Usually in these kinds of cuisines, people really protect their recipes as family secrets.
Well, first of all, I lived there 7 years, and I'm really good at languages. And thirdly, I bring presents. And then I kiss each woman on a cheek and touch my heart. And they are at rest. They know I'm one of them. Remember, I lived there. I know the things to say. And women do share their recipes. They share their recipes with their relatives and neighbors. They don't usually share them with someone like me. But I become one of them. And I'm willing to sit on the floor. I'm willing to sleep on the floor.
You went there initially because you wanted to meet Paul Bowles?
Yeah. In 1959, I first went there. I knew Jack Kerouac. I knew Allen Ginsberg. I knew William Burroughs from New York. And everybody says, you don't go to Paris anymore. You go to Tangier. So in 59, Michael Wolfert, my first husband, and I went off to Tangier. And I became very good friends with Jane Bowles. And my husband became very friendly with Paul. Though I was friendly with Paul, Jane took me under her wing. And we lived there for about a year, and then we went up to Paris, and we lived at the Beat Hotel for about a year. No, but yes, and then 7 more years in Paris. I had some children. I worked at the Paris Review. And then we went back to Tangier in 68, and we lived there another 2 years, but he left. Long story. And then I had to find a way to get back to America.
So all of this time, you really were trying to live the literary life, not the food life.
Yes, that's true.
Do you remember when you first ate Moroccan food?
When I first lived there. I mean, my husband was a teacher.
Was it a shock?
Well, this is what happened. My husband got a job as a teacher at a little school that was training the children of the revolutionaries, the Istiklal Party. They were training them, teaching them English because they were trying to overthrow the French government. In the rest of Morocco, Tangier was an international city at that time, and the Istiklal were hiding out there. So they had this little school that the American government had set up. Guess what part of the American government set it up? But my husband was the English high school English teacher, and I was the librarian. And so the students would invite us home to their houses to eat the food. At that time, people had slaves. I mean, they were good to their slaves.
Well, it's a lot easier to cook labor-intensive food when you have a slave doing the work.
Yes, yes. Also, the place was filled with Spaniards because they were all fleeing from fascist Spain. So it was a very exciting time. And I got hit by cumin right away. I mean, Moroccan cumin is not like any other cumin in the world. In fact, aside from preserved lemons, you got to have Moroccan cumin. And then you can cook anything in my book.
My guest is Paula Wolfert, whose latest book is The Food of Morocco. It's published by HarperCollins. And you say that great national cuisines depend on four factors. What are they?
You know, I wrote that 40 years ago, but I went to my notes because I have to admit I don't remember the beautiful way I expressed it 40 years ago when I was at the height of my career. But they have to have great refinement in the lifestyle of some of the people. They have to have great food. They have to have urban dishes. They have to have palace and peasant food at both levels where people can get things. Morocco, unlike the rest of the Arab world around the Mediterranean, did not have the Ottoman Empire. They produced their own world with the Andalus. And therefore,
they were the Moors of Spain.
That's right. And they produced what they produced between the dates, the spices that came all the way across, the cooking of Persia. They merged all of that with the Berbers. By the way, the Berbers invented tagines. They invented couscous and the cooking of it. This is not something that was brought. So you had this merging of the regional food with all this very great refined cooking of both the Spanish and the Persian. And voila, you're one of the great cuisines of the world.
Why is the quality of chicken especially important when cooking in a tagine?
Because it cooks for a very long time in order to get everything to balance out in flavor. And our American chickens have about 15% water in them, unless you get an organic air-chilled chicken. The air-chilled chickens are the way the Europeans and the North, most people raise chickens. And if you have your own chicken farm, that's what you would do. But these big chicken farms that we have in America, I'm not going to name the companies, maybe. But anyway,
we know who they are.
Yes. You have to avoid them. Bell and Evans is a good chicken. The kosher chickens are good. But these chickens that are 15% water, they throw off the water while you're cooking. They cook fast and they're mush.
And then you say also we should use thighs rather than breasts.
Well, that's because they're not.
Americans prefer white meat.
Make sure you get an air-chilled chicken. But if they're not going to get an air-chilled chicken, they're going to say to me, oh, I can't find an air-chilled chicken or it costs a dollar more a pound, then use the thighs.
Now, is couscous, does it just come out of Moroccan food because of the Berbers?
The couscous we know today is made with semolina, and that was brought by the Arabs. But they used to make couscous back 2,000 years with other grains, millet, with barley. They steamed it because it was a way of softening the grain. And today, people have corn couscous, they have barley couscous, they have green barley couscous, and they have the semolina couscous. But it's always steamed, and it always takes a thin sauce. A tagine always takes a thick sauce. You never should put a tagine sauce on top of couscous. It'll make it collapse, unless you're going to follow the directions on the box. But let me tell you something. If you follow the directions on the box, I hope you're on a diet, because it's going to swell in your stomach. Couscous swells. If you follow the directions on the box, you get 6 cups of couscous. If you steam it, you get 12 cups of couscous. If you steam it even one more time, you'll get 18 cups of couscous. So can you imagine what happens? If you're on a diet, it's great. Couscous is the new savior for fat women.
You say that Moroccan food is spiced but not spicy.
Right, because they use a lot of turmeric, ginger, cinnamon. These are very healthy spices. These go right back to Hippocrates when he was talking about spices from the East and how healthy they were. And one of the, except for sugar, which the Moroccans have a problem with, they really have a very healthy cuisine.
Well, they've obviously embraced other people's ingredients. You have a recipe for tomato magic. Tomatoes from the New World.
Once the Columbian Exchange happened, the Columbian Exchange, all the things that came from the New World went to the Old World, and everything from the Old World went to the New. Europe sent us syphilis, and we sent them tomatoes.
How does a typical Moroccan salad differ from ours?
It's most of them are cooked, or if not cooked, they're raw, and it's a selection of salads. But they're very easy. A lot of them keep 2 or 3 days, so you can make it and just serve a little bit. But you get all your veg. You don't need, when they say to you, you need a half a pound of this and a quarter of a pound of that, just a few tablespoons of a Moroccan salad is all you really need, because it's variety. They don't do the green tossed green salad.
Morocco's changed a lot. People are moving to the cities.
80%.
In every country, when that happens, it changes the way people cook.
That's absolutely true.
So are certain things being lost?
Yes. Just the way in the 1960s we were eating all these frozen dinners, and then all of a sudden this lady comes along on television and teaches the younger people. Their mothers, meanwhile, are off having lunch at Schraff's, and they are following Julia. 25 years later in Morocco, they moved out into the cities, and they're starting eating from cans, and they're starting pressure cooking instead of tagines, and they're starting to go to supermarkets. And guess what? A young 29-year-old girl gets on television, Chumicha, and stirred up the young.
We have a recipe from your cookbook on our website. It's called Trout with Preserved Raisins and Pine Nuts. The book, The Food of Morocco, published by HarperCollins. And my great thanks to Paula Wolford for being on our show again.
Thank you.